Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. It's the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, thinking about a voice you can conjure up even without listening to it. But oh, when you do listen to it, it takes hold and won't let go.
A rock, a river, a tree, hosts to species long since departed, marked the mastodon, the dinosaur, who left dry tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor.
Maya Angelou speaking there at the 1993 inauguration for Bill Clinton, the poem On the Pulse of the Morning. She came close to upstaging the new president on that day. Poet, activist, champion of speaking America's truth to itself, champion of African-American women and men, Maya Angelou has died at age 86 at her home in North Carolina. She was a teacher, a mentor, as well as a central part of the black literary canon that has become the American literary canon, and her words are now part of a global literature of empowerment and social justice. Here she is reciting the poem, And Still I Rise.
Everyone in the world has gone to bed one night or another with fear or pain or loss or disappointment, and yet each of us has awakened, arisen, somehow made our ablution, seen other human beings, and said, morning, how are you? Fine, thanks, and you?
Every bit of love and joy that could be squeezed out of life, she got it. If you talk about who lived a full and a good and a complete life, you come back to Maya.
That's fellow poet Nikki Giovanni reacting to the news of Maya Angelou's death today.
She just had a good American touch for always finding the good. She and I shared a friend whom we both loved dearly named Alex Haley, and you recall Alex Haley from Roots. And Alex had an expression, find the good and praise it. And I think Maya was probably the major practitioner of find the good and praise it.
Maya Angelou was a stern preacher of truth, but she also loved life and embraced it fully. Her life as much a model for people as her words. Her last tweet, listen to yourself, and in that quietude you might hear the voice of God. We turn now to poet Kwame Dawes. He's a professor of English at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
At some point, somebody described her as the sort of poet laureate of black women. I think that is, in a sense, a beautiful thing. And yet, in a sense, it limits just the extent of her influence. One of the things that I've always encountered is when I meet young writers or writers who are attempting to seriously write poetry, I ask them who have they read and who are they interested in. And Maya Angelou's name comes up all the time. So she's ubiquitous in terms of American poetry, both her voice, her themes, and her ideas. And I think what happens is when somebody goes deeper into her poetry, for instance, there's a real sense that there was a poet who was very interested in craft and in the shaping of her poetry in very specific ways. So there's a position that she holds that is unassailable in terms of a voice that speaks to an American sensibility.
And her work changed the language. I mean, everyone knows about caged birds and why they sing. And the three words, still I rise, mean so much because of her work.
Because of her work. And you know, when we think of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, we are also thinking that Maya Angelou is doing something really critical in American letters, which is to hark back to writers who sometimes people ignore. The title of that book comes from the Paul Laurence Dunbar poem. And it's a line from this wonderful poem about masking and about hiding oneself and so on. So Angelou was always aware of creating connections and articulating the history of Africa in America, that great documentary series that she did in the early, late 60s, I think, about African identities and African cultures and so on and so forth in America remains one of the most important things that is done. So she's really important in that way. And with all these autobiographies that explore her life in these rich and fantastic ways, I think we have a legacy in her that is just remarkable, I think.
In your conversations with her and in just your knowledge of her, I mean, she really felt as though her work as a poet was in lockstep with the work of jazz, blues musicians, hip-hop artists. I mean, she had a very celebrated relationship with Tupac Shakur.
Her work came out of that experience. In other words, you know, Maya Angelou, we know her history as a dancer, her history as a jazz singer, her history in performance and, you know, on Broadway, on stage. Angelou was not writing seriously until, you know, in the late 60s. So there's a sense in which she comes out of that culture and that experience. So the connection between the musical sensibility, the jazz, the innovations of African-American culture, culture and African-American life, and her own writing, her poetry, her essays, her autobiographical work is inextricable. And I think she was very, very serious about that and constantly drawing on it as a rich well of possibility in the way that Langston Hughes would have talked about it again and again.
She wrote a poem for the inaugural and recited it at the inauguration of Bill Clinton in 1993. And you really got the sense from her reading that she felt that a moment had arrived. But I'm wondering if she got the timing wrong, if in a sense that moment didn't arrive till much later.
Yeah, we think that. But, you know, the moment had arrived. I mean, on one hand, this was the first inaugural poem since Robert Frost. And we know the position that Robert Frost holds in American culture and American life. To have that inaugural speech made at that time, I think was really important to recognize what was going on, the ferment of great work that was emerging from the African-American community, especially from women in the late 80s and into the 90s. And this represented a kind of articulation of the power of that. It also spoke to her influence. I mean, in the 70s and the 80s, Maya Angelou was all over the world. She was getting honorary doctorates all over the place. She was a very popular voice. People knew her work. And Clinton was no fool. I think he asked her to do it because of what she represented.
And certainly Maya Angelou would always want to be ahead of history, not either on it or behind it. That's for sure. Kwame, thanks so much.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me.
Kwame Dawes is a poet and professor of English at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. The president is trying to settle his foreign policy legacy with some very different words, speaking at West Point today.
Tough talk often draws headlines, but war rarely conforms to slogans. As General Eisenhower said at this ceremony in 1947, war is mankind's most tragic and stupid folly.
The president is using this speech to explain a broader policy and an approach to the world where so much of its future is uncertain and where assumptions about Europe, Russia, Asia, the Middle East, and Afghanistan have all shifted significantly since Obama took office in 2009. Yesterday, the president announced that a force of nearly 10,000 troops will stay in Afghanistan after 2014, an adjustment of a pledge to withdraw troops by 2014. It's a sign of regional turmoil that has bedeviled this administration. Pakistan, in particular, has proved more a complication rather than an asset in the war in Afghanistan. And Pakistan's own war with the Taliban has kept the country unstable and weak as a regional power, even as new leadership in India has offered conciliation to its longtime foe. Joining us now, Christine Fair, author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. She's also a professor at Georgetown University. Christine, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. I always love being on your program.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the legacy here, the Obama legacy. I mean, you write that the Pakistanis have really perfected the art of playing the U.S. card and dealing with the relationship, particularly the less skilled diplomats coming in different administrations. One of the people you cite even described it as the perfected art of the guilt trip. Do you think that was successfully played on the Obama administration here?
I don't think it's so much the case of the Obama administration. Obama came in really disliking Pakistan. I mean, all of the evidence suggests that he very much understood that the real problem was in Pakistan. However, what he shared with the Bush administration, and the Bush administration very much suffered from this, the folks in the Bush administration had absolutely no clue about U.S.-Pakistan relations. The Pakistanis were able to repeatedly sell a very fictionalized, or more generously, a highly stylized version of U.S.-Pakistan relations that they were able to then leverage into things like F-16s and a really enormous military support package. Obama came in, his problem was, is that he really didn't know how to deal with the military. And I would argue, and by military, I mean our military. I think you saw this evidence yesterday in his announcement that was very much a reversal from his preferred position of zero troops in Afghanistan. He's now coming up with what looks to be the commander of ISAF's preferred position of a little under 10,000 troops. He pretty much had to cave to this notion of the surge in Afghanistan. And the problem with the surge in Afghanistan is that it didn't recognize why we were losing the war. And we were losing the war because Pakistan was taking our money, supporting the Taliban and killing our troops. Pakistan's Special Services Group, which is their commandos, actually trained the Afghan Taliban, and according to some of my friends who are special operators in the U.S. military, even fight with the Taliban. So the problem with the surge is that it completely misdiagnosed the problem, which was Pakistan.
What would you say is going on right now in Pakistan in terms of the Taliban? The military has created a monster that's now in the middle of infighting and declaring itself independent, and all kinds of different Taliban factions fighting for the overthrow of the Pakistani government.
Yeah, so actually, one important caveat to this is that the Pakistanis, they're almost like Republicans in their ability to create neologisms. Like, for example, who's not opposed to tax relief at first blush, right? The Pakistanis are the masters of inventing this kind of language. And what they've been able to do is to create this confusion that all Taliban are the same, that the Taliban that are fighting the Pakistani state are the same Taliban that are fighting us in Afghanistan. And that's absolutely not the case. It is true that they share certain ideological alliances, but the Pakistan Taliban are absolutely not the same thing as the Afghan Taliban. The Pakistan Taliban, they have a different origin. Their backbone are groups that have historically fought in Indian Kashmir. And the Pakistan Taliban is very much the product of backlash, whereby the Pakistani military and its intelligence agency, the ISI, raised a whole slew of militant groups that were supposed to try to harass the Indians into making some concessions on Kashmir. And for a variety of reasons, after 9/11 and then President and General Musharraf's decision to align with us, they began turning against the state. Now, this is interesting because this just goes to show how completely disastrous U.S. policy is towards the region. We've been, now just so you know, the new aid figures is $30 billion, $30 billion to Pakistan since 9/11. And what the Pakistan Army is trying to do in its negotiations with the Pakistan Taliban is that it wants them to go to Afghanistan, where it will continue to kill us, our allies, and Afghans. So how perverse is this? That, you know, we've just agreed to keep 10,000 troops in Afghanistan to continue stabilizing that country and so that we don't see an immediate reversal of gains, when the Pakistan army is ever more redoubled upon its own policy of trying to persuade its own Taliban to fight us in Afghanistan. If someone can tell me how this makes sense, I will give anything to them, because this is absolute insanity. But this is our policy.
Christine Fair is the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and she's a professor at Georgetown University.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The World Cup is in Brazil this year, but the lead-up to the 2014 FIFA World Cup tournament has not been very much fun so far. Problems with infrastructure, corruption, busted deadlines. In one city, there's a state of emergency from threats of Amazon River flooding. Now, to some uninitiated Americans, these sorts of problems may be the most understandable thing about World Cup soccer. Don't worry, we're going to help you out. What are Americans to take from Team USA being slotted into what's being called the death group, a bracket with all kinds of powerhouse teams? And by the way, it's in the middle of the possible flood zone. The very British Roger Bennett, one of the two hosts of the Men in Blazers podcast, believes in all seriousness, and that's a real stretch for the acerbic deadpan Bennett, that this World Cup might be America's moment in more ways than one.
This could be the year that America are going to win it all.
No, I feel like you're patronizing.
No. To be candid,
they don't have a chance.
On
right?
Our show, Men in Blazers, we have declared that this is the year that America are going to win it all. But we're always eternally optimistic. You could say they've been handed the devil's hand.
Yeah, I mean, they're in the death group, the group that has the...
It's worse than that, John.
Yeah.
America, they're a joyous team. I mean, the team has never been so deep. There's never been so many options. They have this wonderful coach, a German legend as a player, Jürgen Klinsmann, who fills everyone, the players, his coaches, everybody, with optimism. And so there should be an uplifting sense of opportunity at this World Cup, apart from the gods of FIFA have given the US team. Germany, second-ranked team in the world. Portugal, third-ranked team in the world.
Ouch.
And the team Ghana, who have defeated them at the last two World Cups. But it's worse than that, John. They've given them 9,000 miles of travel through three ecosystems, hot, bloody hot, and Amazonian rainforest, hot, where the good news is we've never lost a game where we played in an Amazonian rainforest. But the travel, the teams, and the kind of ecosystems that they're going to play and make it a trifecta. We say it's like the Hunger Games in cleats. But this is a US team that has collective will, has incredible team belief, has an incredible optimism about it. And Jürgen believes, and I have to believe with him, that they could go down there and shock some people.
Sounds like you're pretty close with Jürg.
Call
him Jürgi?
Do I? You know what? I never look him in the eye. Never look him in the eye. He's a wonderful bloke. For a footballer who's won everything, the World Cup, the European, everything, he's a very sophisticated, cosmopolitan, articulate kind of man of the present. And I've been in this country since 1994, since the World Cup was here in America.
I remember that.
Everyone went to it. It's still the best attended World Cup of all time. But few people watched it if they weren't at the games. I remember trying to get a game in a bar where it was just me and the bar backs who were watching. No one else cared. World Cup to World Cup, the event's popularity has climbed. Whatever the United States do, and in all seriousness, I hope they do remarkably well. I think this is going to be the World Cup, which will be a real kind of vendepunk, a real turning point for the game in this country.
Who else do we need to be looking at? I mean, I, for instance, follow Spain because they actually have a chance of winning.
Mm-hmm. Well, Spain are a remarkable team. For years when I was young, they were just ultimate sporting chokers. They turn up with their Jose's, their Enrique's, their Miguel's, beautiful-looking boys. They'd always be highly fancied. They'd thrash someone 7-1, 8-1 in the opening game. We'd say, this year, Spain are going to do it. And then in the first elimination round, they'd wilt and choke. Spain have beaten that. They've become this beautiful purveyor of the game. They've won the World Cup and either side two European championships. So to win back-to-back-to-back tournaments would be an unbelievable feat. Germany, the other European powerhouse, really are relishing this opportunity. There's a statistic. No European team has ever won the World Cup in South America. You'll hear that a heck of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The honest truth is there's only been two World Cups since 1950 in South America. So it's just not such a daunting statistic. But Argentina, phenomenal team. Lionel Messi, beautiful offensively, incredible kind of murderer's row of elite talent. That would be a feat to see them win the World Cup in their rival Brazil. But you look at this Brazil team, they are expected to win. In 1950, they last hosted. They lost in the final game. Nelson Rodriguez, the great playwright, a gentleman who's probably even more hyperbolic than me, John, he called it our Hiroshima. He said, in a country with no wars, that loss is he called it an open wound that none of the five subsequent wins have healed. He called it our Hiroshima. Can you imagine that? For players to have to take the field knowing that they have to avoid that.
That's outrageous. I mean, it's also the case that in Brazil this year, there may be a lot of people rooting against the home team. There's so much bad feeling about the money spent on the stadium.
It's so complicated. Brazil desperately wants this World Cup so that the country can be known for something more than footballers and supermodels. It wants to deliver a message to the world, but the cities, as we speak, are kind of frothing over with social unrest. There's an incredible amount of anger at the amount of money that I wouldn't even use the word invested, I'd say be wasted on this tournament. Incredible amount of corruption, incredible amount of infrastructure promises unfulfilled. I was at the Confederations Cup, the dry run for the World Cup in 2013, when the protests just flared up. And it was fascinating because the cities would burn themselves down during games. You'd watch football being played and there'd be tear gas hovering in a cloud over the game. But when Brazil played, the country still stopped. And when they took the field, they'd play the first verse of the national anthem. And FIFA would stop it as they do any first verse, done. And then the people would stand up in the stadium and a cappella sing the second verse. and the players, they'd weep during the national anthem, and then they would attack all comers like a pack of hungry dire wolves. And so watching them will be unbelievable. If they go deep into the tournament, Brazil will love them. If they go out early, John, I mean, the social unrest may well boil over, and Brazil will deliver a very different message to the world than the one it wants.
What about the sleepers? Uruguay, going to be a Cameroon? How about North Korea?
And well, North Korea will have a job trying to win this tournament, yeah, seeing as they didn't qualify for it.
Right.
I'm sad they didn't. They're an unbelievable football team. They still edit their games. So North Korea, on North Korean television, have still never leaked a goal. They edit out any goals the opponents score. It's a wonderful way to broadcast.
It is really interesting. Yeah.
The US should do that, to be honest. Yeah. It would be amazing. And then the other team are Chile, who people are looking at and saying this could be a team that will move itself up to the elite of South American football. Or Belgium, coming out of Europe, may prove that it's good for something else other than chocolate, Brussels sprouts and serial killers.
Chocolate, Brussels sprouts, and serial killers.
Is what you think? I can you read your mind. That's
you
what you think of when you think of Belgium.
Friends in Belgium, I guess.
I love Belgium. Plastique Bertrand.
Yeah, I can tell. Roger, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on, John. Go USA.
Roger Bennett is one of the hosts of the podcast Men in Blazers. Roger and his partner Michael Davies will host Men in Blazers live on Broadway this Friday night. A night in conversation with the U.S. men's national team stars, past and present, right here in New York City.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. In Detroit, you might say the war is over, but the evidence, in some cases literal rubble, remains on the streets of Detroit. As bankruptcy attempts to make the city solvent, Detroit will need some heavy equipment to remake its skyline and neighborhoods and begin the rebuilding effort. The Detroit Blight Removal Task Force recommends that the city spend at least $850 million to knock down about 40,000 damaged buildings and either fix or destroy thousands of others. The ultimate price tag, $1 billion. Here's Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan.
6 months ago, we had no strategy and no funding. We're standing here today. We've got the strategy, and we're getting started on the funding, and I'm very excited about our future.
And that future apparently involves bulldozers. For more, we go to Quinn Kleinfelter, senior news editor for WDET. Quinn, welcome.
Hello, John.
So what is it that needs to be destroyed, removed? I mean, a lot of the industrial legacy of Detroit is really in the crosshairs of this task force.
It is to an extent, but not actually at this time. It's going to be in demolition phase two, at least according to the officials you talked about, which do include the mayor, Mike Duggan, and a task force that was appointed by the White House to look at this. It's chaired by three people, including the Quicken Loans founder, Dan Gilbert, who's pouring lots of investment into the city. And at the moment, they're going to focus on residential and small buildings, small strip malls and the like that are abandoned. They're all over the city. As you say, in many ways, it does resemble a former war zone. And it's been hard to exactly spot where things are in the city because there's so much blight that envelops Detroit. This project that they're presenting the results from was unprecedented almost for any large city. It was a mapping project where they sent people about and took pictures of every parcel of land, 377,000, and then determined from there that there was this vast amount, 80-some thousand, that needed to be addressed one way or the other. And they want to try to find this money. The problem is they've only got about half of that $850 million at the moment, and a lot of that is only pledged. So actually finding the funds to tear all these things down is going to be a challenge.
And on two fronts, it seems to be this goes way, way beyond Detroit. I mean, on the one hand, this is really a template for massive urban renewal in the 21st century. I mean, as you say, no city's done anything like this. And the model that's established here will be replicatable in other cities around the world. And secondly, you know, psychologically, how important is this to the people of Detroit to see a demolition, a kind of a wiping of the slate clean?
Well, on both fronts, it's vitally important. Blight is not only just a cancer, as I referred to it, it's a symbol that your city is in decay and a magnet for crime. And trying to reverse that is something that the city desperately needs. The city itself of Detroit owns a fair amount of properties. They found that 93% of the properties that were owned by the city were blighted, you know, a tremendous amount. So the city was one of the, if you want to put it that way, worst slumlords in Detroit.
And in theory, if the demolition takes place and they come up with the money, the city will have important assets for reinvestment, assuming that that land can be put to a different kind of use in the 21st century. Quinn, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Quinn Kleinfelder, senior news editor for WDET in Detroit, about a program to eliminate vast amounts of urban blight in the city of Detroit. Listen to this now. It's from the Detroit suburbs. One of our listeners, Mark from Michigan, sent this bit of sound after our discussion yesterday about the difference between sound and noise recorded on a rainy, dark day. What is that, sound or noise? You can send us audio of your city and tell us if it is sound or noise. Just send it to us. Email it as an MP3 to takeawayaudio at gmail.com. Again, that's takeawayaudio at gmail.com. The difference between decipher, D-E-C-I-P-H-E-R, that's correct, and decipher, D-E-S-Y-F-E-R, sounds the same, but wrong. Now, it may be minimal, and on the radio, it's non-existent, right? But at the National Script Spelling Bee, the difference of just a single letter can change the world. It can certainly change lives. And 281 lives from around the country began putting their spelling talents on the line for this year's competition last night outside Washington, D.C. George Stampy remembers it all very well. Don't you, George?
I sure do. It feels like it was yesterday. That type of nervousness and that, you know, the butterflies in your stomach, it's hard to forget that. I had notebooks, which if you stacked them up, were taller than me as a 12-year-old. I had tens of thousands of words in these books, and I had been drilling them constantly. But the fact of the matter is, you don't know what you're going to get until you step up to the mic.
Now, how does the pressure ratchet up as you approach the final championship round? And you're the winner in the 2000 Spelling Bee.
Yeah, you know, as the rounds go on and the ranks dwindle, you know, you get a little nervous, a little more nervous just because you realize the words are getting harder. And, you know, just the fact that you're going to get words that you don't know how to spell. And so you're going to have to do some sleuthing and understand how you can really figure out words which are from abstruse origins, you know.
Right.
You get words from all around the globe, all around, you know, different historical periods. And it can be really challenging, but the pressure is certainly stepping up from round to round, that's for sure.
It's a deciphering situation that you have to do, especially when you come up against a word that you don't know, but you have to use the clues and the pronunciation to actually make a stab that's going to win for you. Now, when you're in the competition and you hear other people competing and winning and losing, right?
That's correct.
Do you ever, when you're sitting in the audience, hear a word that you know would have eliminated you, and but for the grace of luck, I guess, you didn't get that word?
Oh, certainly. I believe, you know, and I, like you said, I was a competitor and a champion, you know, more than a decade ago, but I really believe that the level of competition has really increased. And in the modern age, kids collaborate and they study more. They have found new ways of aggregating difficult words and drilling them at higher volumes than we did, if that were even possible. And so I really believe the level of competition has really increased. The words that you hear in these years' bees are words that would have been totally alien to me back when I was studying for this.
No, you sound completely breathless now, and you're making me actually quite nervous. But you're a judge this year. You're not competing.
That's correct. Thankfully, I am not competing, but I got to confess, I still am a little nervous for the students who participate. It's a, you know, it's a huge investment of time that they've made into this competition, and, you know, they are incredibly serious about it.
Is it too much pressure sometimes for something that you can use spell check for in the end in your life?
You know, there's a number of different things in life where you can pressure yourself beyond what's appropriate. You're correct. We do have spell check, and many of the words that you're going to hear, especially in the more advanced rounds, are not words that are commonly used.
Right.
But this is an incredible outlet for competition and for camaraderie among the spellers. And, you know, there is an incredible level of respect for what they've managed to achieve and to to master.
All right. So congratulations, of course, for being the 2000 champion. Congratulations for being a judge. That can't be your full-time gig. Where are you today?
I live in St. Louis, Missouri, and I work at the assistant to the CEO of a large Catholic hospital.
And this fall, what are your plans?
This fall, I'll be starting as a first year at the Stanford Graduate School of Business to pursue an MBA.
Well, George Thampy, thanks so much for speaking with us.
The honor's mine. Thank you.
George Thampy was the 2000 Scripps Spelling Bee winner, and as he said, he will be attending Stanford's Graduate School of Business this fall.
I put a spell on you.
So what's your consistent spelling error, your decipher?
Hey, my name is Jess, and I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. The word that I used to misspell was grammar. I spelled it with an E-R at the end, so it's the proper A-R.
Baton Rouge, Louisiana writes, I often misspell the word scissors. Remembering the time I lost a spelling bee in third grade helps me spell it correctly. Memory's great that way. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. You can find us, too, on Facebook.com/TheTakeaway. You know better, Daddy. I can't stand it
because you put me down. Yeah, yeah. This might have been the sound of the beach in Normandy, northern France, nearly 70 years ago.
Come on, you lot. Hurry it up.
That's what Hollywood imagined the D-Day invasion sounded like in the 1962 movie, The Longest Day. It was the biggest engineering and military mobilization in world history, and the commander of Allied forces, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, knew it.
Sailors and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you.
June 6, 1944 was D-Day, landing millions of troops on well-defended beaches, pushing the Germans back, then creating harbors for the landing of a full-fledged army of tanks and vehicles to push in to liberate Paris and then occupy Berlin. This was as much about bulldozers as it was bullets. In a new Nova film airing tonight on PBS stations, a team of archaeologists and historians have been investigating the incredible technology and engineering behind the makeshift harbors those troops and engineers built 70 years ago. The Mulberry Harbor is one of them you can still see. Nova's D-Day's Sunken Secrets was produced by our partner WGBH and features Tim Beckett, the director of Beckett Rankin Marine Consulting Engineers in London, whose father was one of the engineers on the project. We'll hear from him in just a moment. And Doug Hamilton is the producer, writer, and director of the film, which shows a very different side to D-Day we don't normally see on the big screen.
One of the things that I think we don't think about, you know, having watched Saving Private Ryan and The Longest Day, is we focus very much on the initial landings, the 4 or 5 hours that it took to get control of Omaha Beach. And that's an incredibly heroic story. But the operation would not have been successful if we couldn't land all the millions of men and tons and tons and tons of equipment that's required to sustain the invasion and move forward. You know, it's an amazing thing. A port the size of Dover was installed off the beaches in 3 days. It's an incredible thing.
Tim Beckett, how much of a technological marvel was it to have a roadway basically floating in the waves?
Well, the roadway floating in the waves was my father's design. Mulberry Harbour, or the artificial harbours, were very much Churchill's concept. It was well known we were going to have to land in France eventually. The Germans knew it as well as we did. And floating bridges have been done before across rivers, the Romans had them, but never in the open sea with all the motions that involved. And to actually tow it across the channel and then install it rapidly was, well, I believe it was an outstanding achievement which was critical to the success of Mulberry.
When you think about everything that happened and your father's achievements, on the scale of things, as an engineer might assess it, how ambitious was D-Day from an engineering perspective?
From the engineering perspective, it was hugely ambitious, not just to design and construct it and transport it over there, but also remarkably to keep it secret. Without the surprise element, it probably wouldn't have been a success.
It's really hard to imagine the scale of this. And one of the things we did in the film is work with Dassault Systems, a French engineering company, to do this animation that brought these Mulberry Harbors to life. You know, they, if you go to the coast of France now, you just see the remains, the sort of concrete blocks that were brought over. And they give you a sense of how big it is, but not really how this was a functioning port. And we interview the chief historian for the Navy, and he said, you know, you had these large ships, LSTs, landing ship tanks, that could carry 200 men and 20 tanks, basically, and land them on the beach. Landing them on a beach and unloading them took about 10 hours because of the tides that you had to work around and the whole process of getting this ship up onto the sand. Once the Mulberry Harbors were in operation, they were able to pull up at the pier and unload the entire ship in about an hour and a half.
Wow.
And then go back out to sea. So it really added to the efficiency of unloading.
So, Doug, you also collaborated with Bill Allen and Jim Booth, D-Day veterans, who got a glimpse below the water of the havoc and the chaos that really is nowhere in evidence today in Normandy. What was that like for them?
It was extraordinary. You know, we were actually on the expedition locating ships with the sonar. And then after we found a ship that we could dive on, we contacted the veterans. I remember calling up Bill Allen and asking if he would come, and 2 weeks later he was there. It was an incredibly significant event for him. He had not been able to talk about his experiences with his family or anyone else for 50 years. And it was only in the last few years that he began to think he would be interested in returning to Normandy. But he's 88 years old and didn't really think that opportunity would ever come. So coming back was hugely important. One of the first things he said to me is that he would like to see the grave of his commanding officer, one of the men who died on the ship that he was on, because someone like Bill Allen will say, listen, I'm not the hero. The heroes are the guys that died there.
And all the fearless individuals with a part to play in the D-Day landings, Churchill played his part too. Tim, given what was at stake, this was really something Churchill could not afford to get wrong.
Churchill was wrong quite a few times on many issues, but I think that on this one, he was insistent that there would not be landings without the proper support of artificial harbours. And I think on this, he was right. And you think that we were up against Rommel, who everybody had huge respect for in Normandy. But if Rommel lost a tank in battle, it would take him 2 weeks to get a replacement down from Germany by rail. If the Allies lost a tank in battle by using Mulberry Harbour, they could have a replacement in 2 days, brought over from England. And it was that difference that ultimately meant that we were going to defeat the Germans.
Tim Beckett, director of the Beckett Rankin Marine Consulting Engineers, son of the man who created the engineering for the harbors, the floating harbors. And Doug Hamilton, producer, writer, and director of NOVA's D-Day's Sunken Secrets. Tim and Doug, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
One of the great stories is how science and the curiosity about how the world works became civilization. Science begat medicine. Science begat electronics and the power grid. Physics begat radio, broadcasting, digital signal processing. Biology begets modern agriculture. Mechanics and physics get you cars and flight. Civilization is a festival of scientific discoveries and science's applications to everyday life. It is this spirit that is captured in the 7th annual World Science Festival, which opens in New York City today and streamed around the world. Festival events bring you up close to your genes, your bosons, leptons, and fermions. You can also touch a scale replica of the comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko. No, it's not named after the drummer from Pussy Riot. But even if it was, our next guests would be all over it. Brian Greene, physicist, string theorist, and professor at Columbia University and World Science Festival co-founder. And also with me, actor, writer, and director Alan Alda. Alda wrote Dear Albert, a reading for the stage about the life and work of Albert Einstein, being performed tonight with the World Science Festival. Brian Greene, welcome to The Takeaway, or welcome back, I should say.
Thank you.
And same to you, Alan Alda. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And in this festival week here for the World Science Festival, I wanted to ask both of you, when was the first time you thought like a scientist? You did something that felt like this must be what scientists do. Did you ever have that experience, Alan?
I did. It was when I was reading something and a ghost told me to consult a scientist. A guy had been dead 200 years, and he said, this is the way nature is made in three parts. Ask any physicist. So I asked a physicist who lived across the street. Because I was in my early 20s, and I was interested in spiritualism. So I was sort of believing it because it sounded interesting, you know. Well, that's good. Good to have curiosity. But I asked the physicist across the street, and he said, I never heard of anything like that. So I said, well, I know. The answer will be in Scientific American magazine. And I started reading every issue, every article in every issue. And that was the beginning for me, I think, of thinking like a scientist, because I didn't just accept things that sounded interesting. I wanted to explore the evidence behind it.
Age 22, and those old issues of Scientific American are fantastic. I mean, they really were, you know, written in that font that looked very intimidating.
And it was during that time that they said the continents are moving apart. And I had already figured out that they fit together like puzzle pieces. And I thought, wow. You can actually look and observe things, and then they come up with evidence to show it that it's so.
Brian, how about you? When did you first feel like you were doing something that scientists would do?
Yeah, it was definitely in high school when our physics teacher set us a problem of a baseball hanging from a ceiling by a piece of chewing gum. And we had to figure out if you let the ball swing and the bubble gum would stretch, what would be the trajectory of the baseball? And I remember sitting at home at my desk in the back room doing the calculation. I got the answer. And it was like this thrilling moment that you could do calculations on a piece of paper and figure out something about the real world. And I remember I ran down the hallway to show to my dad, and he was excited too, although, you know, baseball hanging by chewing gum, it's not exactly the most exciting of problems. But the idea that you could discern reality by doing calculations, that was a real turning point for me.
So you didn't have a ghost talking to you?
Yeah, you know, when you heard your answer, all of a sudden my answer felt so flat. I don't have any ghosts or anything, but I got to, you know, that's the truth.
Well, no, but when you retell the story, Brian, you can say, and at that moment, I was channeling Isaac Newton.
That's good. That's good.
Something like that. So but part of what the festival is about is dedicated to the idea that everyone should try and think like a scientist. Everyone isn't going to be a scientist, and everyone is going to win a Nobel Prize, but thinking like a scientist is a binding force in society in the 21st century, right, Brian?
That's one of the hopes I have for this. Yep. Brian, do you have any evidence? Do we have any exit polls or anything that indicate that a few more people are thinking like scientists?
Yeah, we do, you know, a lot of surveys after the programs, and people do say that by going to the World Science Festival, they're able to reclaim science. For many people, they got turned off from science when they were a kid, a teacher in school, or just memorizing facts, something that really turned them away from science. And then they come to a World Science Festival program. You know, many of them are hosted by John Hockenberry himself, which is a fantastic thing to experience him talking to the scientist.
Thank you very much, Brian.
And, you know, when you leave a program where the subject was science, but it made your heart race, that's an experience that changes your relationship to science. And that's a literal story. Someone wrote to us that in one of the programs, it was actually one of yours, John, that in the audience, this woman, her heart was racing because it was so exciting. And that is what we want to have happen, because that's when people realize that science is this powerful way of understanding reality.
Now, you have taken your interest in science and developed dramatic pieces. You know, you tried to write a play. I mean, you wrote a play.
I did write a play.
Yeah, absolutely.
First, you have to try it.
Yeah, yeah. Then you do it. how do you fuse this sense of entertainment, because you're trained as an actor, and this interest in science to create narratives?
I think they go together naturally. Science is a great story. It's a great detective story. And when it's told like that, you can't take your eyes off it. But here, it follows Aristotle's rules of drama. You have somebody who's trying to achieve something that's got a great payoff to it, if that person can achieve it. But they're facing obstacles that are almost impossible to overcome.
You know, there's so many regular movies that we see today that are filled with pop scientific questions and people at computers trying to figure stuff out. I don't know if either of you saw this movie, Particle Fever, about the discovery of the Higgs boson.
I haven't seen it yet. Have you, Brian?
I've not seen it yet, although it's actually going to be at the festival, and I heard it's great.
It's unbelievable because it is the real science. I mean, yes, there's lots of computers, there's lots of screens, but I'm telling you, when they make the discovery, I mean, no special effects, and they're announcing it in that room, I mean, you are just, the tears are pouring down your face. It is an unbelievable story, and it's all about the most advanced esoteric physics that there is.
That's one of the reasons that I've written these two theater pieces. One is about Marie Curie, and the other is about Einstein, that's going to be on tonight. And the reason is that what you just described was a bunch of human beings, fellow people in a room, having achieved this very difficult thing. And you can identify with them as people, as fellow people. And what I'm trying to do in these plays is show you the person behind the scientist so that you can say, oh, this is somebody very much like me, only extremely smart. But they have the same human frailties and human problems that I do and people I know.
Well, guys, I will see you later.
Yeah,
at the festival.
Great.
And thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us both.
Alan Alder, actor, writer, and director, and one of the hosts on stage at the World Science Festival. Brian Green is physicist and string theorist, professor at Columbia University, and World Science Festival co-founder. Brian and Alan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Was a poet who was very interested in craft and in the shaping of her poetry in very specific ways. So there's a position that she holds that is unassailable in terms of a voice that speaks to an American sensibility.
Poet and Professor Kwame Dawes reminding us of Maya Angelou's voice in poetry, music, and politics. She died today at the age of 86. Add your voice at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
Hide the crystal ball by the fence so they won't find the evidence. Get somebody to tell a lie.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR, TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.